Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday. It is the 25th of February, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and a great pleasure to have you with us. Let me remind you that you can be a part of the program. It's very easy. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. If you have another address, don't use it because we will not get it. Panel@wamc.org is the one we look at for letters to be included in the program. Obviously, we can't get to them all, but we can certainly get to as many as possible. And if we don't get to yours, please do not take it personally. Okay, let me introduce the group to you. And we'll get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you, my friend?
Good morning, Chief. I'm just fine and I'm very happy to be alive.
Good. Well, I'm happy you're alive too.
Back to you.
And we'll keep that. We'll, you know, just keep that going as long as we can. Bard College's Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy, Malia Dumont, joins us. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Hi, good morning, Joe. I'm happy to be alive as well, and I'm glad to say that today I'll be able to stay with you the whole time, unlike last week when I had to leave early.
That's all right. We understand, and we thank you for taking the time out that you did, and you made it. You know, you made it through the good part. We welcome your input as always. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Acarius Kelly joins us. Vera, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. The sun is shining. You know, spring might be springing at some point, so it's excellent.
I was tooling down the 787 yesterday and looked down at my car thermometer and 52 degrees, and it felt weird, but good. Ira Fussfeld is publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, our good friend. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I am well. Hope everybody is. Good morning to the panel. And hopefully we'll make some sense out of this crazy world this morning.
Well, that is what we try to do. That is our attempt each and every day. and I know you'll let us know how we do on that. Okay, we're going to start off with the story about governors under attack. And I'm not going to go quite in the direction that you may think I'm going to go in. Given the governor's situation in New York, but he is included in this article that was in the New York Times today. A recall for Newsom in California? Talk grows as governors come under attack. It's an interesting article about how California has been upended by the coronavirus. Most of the state is waiting impatiently for vaccinations. Schools in big cities have yet to reopen their classrooms. Prison inmates and international fraud rings may have looted as much as $30 billion from the state's pandemic unemployment insurance program. And the governor is coming under a lot. Gavin Newsom is really coming under great fire for this. The Times writes, a year into the coronavirus crisis, Mr. Newsom is not the only governor who has hit a political rough patch across the country. Pandemic-weary Americans are taking their rage and grief out on chief executives. In Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine, whose voter approval soared at the start of the pandemic, has been assailed for his strict enforcement of health precautions. Governor Greg Abbott was under fire for runaway infection rates in the Texas border cities even before winter storms collapsed for the power grid. Crashes of the vaccine appointment system in Massachusetts have eaten away at the once unassailable popularity of Governor Charlie Baker. With Marianne Marsh, a Boston political strategist, saying for the first time he has a true political opponent, and it's COVID-19. And of course, in New York, Governor Cuomo's national image as a leader during the pandemic has suffered amid questions around New York's incomplete count of coronavirus-related deaths of nursing home residents. Alan, in your opinion, why are governors having such a tough time of it?
Well, look, the COVID thing is so salient in people's minds. And by salience, I mean, how important is a news story to people? Well, staying alive is a very salient issue, and I can tell you that people are very, very concerned about, you know, getting the COVID relief, and you know, it just shows in every way possible. Now, when people are afraid and when they're angry, you know, you got to find appropriate targets, and the appropriate targets, pardon me, right now, you know, are the governors who lead, but who can't give the answers that a lot of the voters and the people who are out there want. So they get very angry, and they're just looking for relief. I get it.
How fair is it for the governors, and what can they do as they try to not only run their states, not only make the situation better, but sure, have an eye on reelection?
Well, I take it you're still talking to me, which
I am.
Is that nothing in life is fair. So, for example, is it fair that they get all of the credit when times are good? But it's not fair when the times are bad, and as they are right now, and people are really worried and really scared. I have seen this personally. I know that it's so. We just have to understand that people are scared. A better term would be scared to death about all of this. And so they need targets. The targets are the governors. You take the good with the bad, and that's what's happening.
Vera.
Well, I would agree with what Alan pointed out. Guidance came through the prior administration, but now the governors carry all the responsibility for the policies implemented in their states. So it is obvious that questions related to school openings, safety for teachers and children, particularly sort of addressing vulnerable community members, issues related to opening businesses, all of this is now on the backs of governors. Now, if you make a mistake like Gavin Newsom and you have a big party and a fancy restaurant and you're publicly seen when you tell everybody else to stay home, now that's a really big issue because people consider you a hypocrite. And he's right to be criticized for that. So governors carry the responsibility, but it's also interesting to watch how his opposition is trying to work against him. They're using a Swiss cheese approach. They're trying to weaken the governor's reputation by criticizing him in all ways. And that happens across the entire United States by pursuing lawsuits, by, you know, weaving in these QAnon sort of conspiracy theories, mixing it up with anti-vaxxers. And that is a reality that all governors face. But now, since they are political leaders in their states, they have to carry the responsibility and work on becoming exceptionally transparent and explain over and over again to their citizens what is happening, what is changing, and why it's happening.
Great points. Ira.
Well, you know, it's hard to divorce the problem that the governors are in with two salient points. The word of the day, salient. But one is that this pandemic is obviously something that has never happened in this country, at least certainly in the last 100-some-odd years. The governors and the federal government started with a clean sheet of paper as to how this is supposed to be handled. And then so that would obviously lead to potential for missteps and problems along the way simply because they've never been through it before. Compounding it, of course, is the fact that the Trump administration, and Trump in particular, essentially handed the ball to the states, washed his hands with it, and said, here, you fix it. And it seems to me this was something that needed a precise and concise and affirmative federal response. The governors handling it, handling issues that were particular to their own states. But the governors were left with making up their own policies as they went along. And it just seems to me this confluence of factors has put these governors where they are. And finally, California, of course, is unique in so many different ways, not the least of which is that they are very aggressive on these recall attempts. We know that they successfully recalled the Republican Governor Davis some years ago, who was replaced by Schwarzenegger, who in fact then was the subject of a potential but unsuccessful recall attempt as well. So there are a lot of factors here, but the first and foremost is that this pandemic is bigger and bigger than anyone he had ever encountered, and there was no playbook.
Malia.
Yeah, I think it's interesting and striking to realize that not all governors are being equally criticized. So let's consider the example of Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, who opened South Dakota for business last year. And as a result, South Dakota then experienced a surge where it had the highest rate of hospitalization and deaths in the world. And yet she still has a really high approval rating in her state. And that's partly because of how she has branded this as freedom, right? So I think there's a number of reasons that some governors are being sort of unequally criticized, and others are, like Kristi Noem of South Dakota, are sort of somehow being unfairly benefiting from policies that clearly hurt their people. And one is just the difficulty of communicating the very complex information around public health. And I think in general, Democrats, they really try to communicate the public health information, and people like Kristi Noem haven't focused on that at all. They've branded it as freedom. They've left the public health, these complicated issues to the side. And that makes them, appear, it's harder for Republicans to, be criticized by their people in that way. Also, I think under the pandemic, the governors have been thrust into the spotlight more. I mean, a lot of times, in normal times, governors are operating in relative obscurity, right? Under the pandemic, people are becoming aware in brand new ways of how county governments operate, where their role is, how they interact with state governments. I think there's still a lot of limited understanding of where the roles and responsibilities lie. So in some cases, governors are being blamed for things that are going wrong at the federal level. And again, that's very complex, and it's really hard to convey that kind of complexity. And then I'd also say that the Democrats in general tend to focus on accountability more. And I agree with focusing on accountability, but when you highlight that as something that's important to you, then you get criticized more for things like what Gavin Newsom did, you know, going out to eat once without a mask, when people like Kristi Noem, who aren't focusing on accountability, don't get criticized for much more egregious actions. So I think there's a number of reasons why you're seeing this sort of unequal criticism.
Alan, go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, the other thing you don't want to do if you're a governor is make a mistake. And for example, Andrew Cuomo made a mistake, in this whole reporting of the
nursing homes.
The nursing homes. Right. And now we're hearing about sexual stuff. You got to be very careful. When things are going good, you're not going to get criticized. But when they're going bad, you see what's happening.
Alan, is there a recall provision in New York?
There is not. Not that I know of. Nope.
Yeah. And, hey, what do you think of the concept of recall?
I'm all for it. Not in this particular case. I'm not saying Cuomo should be recalled.
But the overall idea.
But the more options that you give to people, the better off you are. So I'm for it. Yep.
Alan, we got a letter I wanted you to respond to, have the whole group, but it's from Jill, and it says, believe it or not, most of the complaints I hear on the streets and among friends and family is not so much a fear of getting COVID, but being sick and tired of the restrictions and being desperate to get back to normal. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's driving a lot of this, right?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. It's driving me crazy, as a matter of fact. I stay home, and I'm married to a wonderful, talented, incredibly investigative woman who likes to get out, and she does. So that's the kind of thing that will cause a certain amount of friction within a family, if you're following me at all.
Well, I'm following every word.
Sounds like a recall.
She may recall me, yes, it's true.
Vera, anything on that?
Oh, well, I was just thinking about the recall issue in California and the guy that's trying to, the guy that's considering running as the candidate with a premier candidate. Grinnell is an interesting character, of course, right? So he was ambassador to Germany last. And he immediately got himself in trouble as the ambassador to Germany because he challenged the German government in terms of its Iran negotiations. He went on Twitter, critiqued politicians. He also endorsed the Alternative für Deutschland, which is the, you know, hard right, I would say, reactionary white supremacist party. He called that party conservative. So there's a whole history behind the strategies that are being used to weaken Newsom and to pull together this new coalition of opponents, ranging from, you know, conservative to extreme right. So this is the attempt to really reorder California, because these attempts are being made in multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and diverse areas by Republicans across the board.
We need to take a break, so we'll pause there. And when we come back, we'll continue. We have letters from listeners, and we welcome yours as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld. We will continue our conversation, but first news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld on the program this morning. We got letters. This one from Zach. The American people need to stop their bloodlust. We need to stop attacking our governors who saved our lives when the federal government and President 45 did nothing and acted like they were their own entity with no responsibility to the whole country. If Trump didn't cause such a royal screw-up, maybe we wouldn't have a bunch of governors getting attacked by the Republican people they from the very people they saved. The nation is grieving and in pain, I understand, but let's not forget who actually got things done when the world was ending. That from Zach. Joel has a similar thought, in which he says if Trump hadn't totally screwed up the pandemic response and the initial vaccine distribution, the governors would not now be the targets of blame. There would be nothing to blame them for, except, of course, the corruption of the Florida governor. Kudos to the governor of Vermont come from Jonathan. Don't forget your neighboring state of Vermont. I would never vote for him, but Phil Scott has done a fabulous job of keeping the state on a unified course. Sort of a backhanded compliment. He's a great guy. I wouldn't vote for him, but he's a great guy. And then this one from Robert. Given the growing scandals in New York, does the panel see any potential New York State Republican contenders who could actually give Cuomo a serious fight, or would his biggest fight be a primary challenge?
The answer to that is you never know. I don't think there have been some polling on this, and nobody can touch him right now. He's still in the mid to upper 50s in his numbers. That's a lot for a politician, remembering that Trump never got out of the 40s and sometimes out of the low 30s and the middle 30s. So he's doing okay so far. He's back where he's always been in terms of his polling. He's not at the 70% level or the 60-something percent, which he was. But, you know, now can a Republican win? I'm going to prove it to you. You ready?
Yep.
Two words, George Pataki, otherwise known as who he, you know, nobody knew who the guy was. They had, you know, it was enough Mario. It happened to be a very Republican year, by the way. He, you know, Pataki came on. He was unknown. People were ready for arrest, and he survived for three terms. That's a lot.
So this comes as the Times Union is reporting a former staffer for Governor Andrew Cuomo, who in December accused the governor of sexually harassing her, published a personal essay Wednesday saying the governor asked her to play strip poker on a private jet, flirted with her inappropriately, and kissed her without consent. The post was published on Medium by Lindsay Boylan, a former staffer at Empire State Development and advisor to Cuomo. She ran unsuccessfully for Congress last election cycle and is now running for Manhattan Borough President. The disclosure by Boylan, who has declined to be interviewed by reporters about her allegations, sparked harsh reactions from many lawmakers, including fellow Democrats who have not normally spoken out against Cuomo. State Senate Majority Leader Andrew Stewart Cousins, a Democrat, called Boylan's allegations deeply disturbing. So there's no doubt about it that the allegations are disturbing. I find what's interesting about the story is that the allegations were initially made in December. One of the problems was that there was the story didn't really go any further because she refused to talk about it and have any interviews. And now this piece comes out with obviously adding more to the story, but still not talking about letting the press in, which is certainly her right. But the question is, where does it go from here? So, Alan, what do you make of this situation for the governor? And I ask it in political terms, in the sense of given everything else that has been coming this governor's way over the past 2 weeks.
Well, first of all, I think that this governor is going to survive. I do. I think he made a series of mistakes. And I'm telling you now, my only advice to him are twofold. One, don't make mistakes. And two, keep your mouth shut when you don't have to. His diatribe with Assemblyman Kim was a perfect example. Here is this guy, Kim, an assemblyman, I believe, from Queens, who has no, you know, standing, and Cuomo attacks him with everything he's got. What does that do for Cuomo? Nothing. But what does it do for Kim? A lot. It makes him into somebody who he wasn't before. So the other thing is that when you bully people, they're going to come back at you. And we do know that the leaders of the legislature in both houses who have really spoken out, some people would say prematurely, some people would say not, about how disturbing these sexual allegations are. You know, my father used to say when he worked around City Hall in New York, don't kick a kid in knee pants because it may turn out later on that he's going to be your boss. There is always the possibility that people who have been nursing grudges for a while, as Plunkett of Tammany Hall once said, seen their opportunities and they took them.
Boylan writes in the essay, Governor Andrew Cuomo has created a culture within his administration where sexual harassment and bullying is so pervasive that it is not only condoned but expected. Minus the sexual harassment part, this, of course, feeds into so many of the other stories that have been reported about the governor and his administration over the past several weeks. Vera?
Yeah, I mean, I have to completely agree with you. We know in detail what the bullying techniques have been, and we know Cuomo is a micromanager. He threatens his staff. He talks over them. He doesn't listen to advice. I mean, just look at the public health the panel and the physicians and the individuals that have all stepped down and walked away. Cuomo is really difficult to work with. Or to work for. Now, the new element is, of course, a series or at least two now sexual harassment cases that have been publicly disclosed. And so now we have to see if there are multiple more cases, if there is a pattern, which then, of course, needs to be investigated. So I would actually say Cuomo is in trouble. So those are the kinds of combined crises that are hard to oppose. And I kind of agree. If I was sitting in Cuomo's office giving him advice, I would say, caution. Don't speak too much about these issues. Listen to your legal team, because now you have the whole crisis related to, you know, misleading the public on the numbers of deaths in nursing homes. A lot of people walked away from you and decided you were not effectively leading the public health crisis, except for the comments on the Emmy award winning weekly and then daily performances. So I would think he's in a bit of hot water And we'll have to see how this new element of sexual harassment now plays out.
I just want to clarify one thing that you said. It's from two women. I believe this is the second allegation from the same woman. I think there's only one allegation.
Is it? Okay. I thought I saw another story earlier today.
It could be. From what I know, this is the sole one, but mm-hmm. That's the one
that I know of. Yeah, that would obviously make a difference. If there are other women coming forward, then it's real trouble.
The other thing too is I did want to read the statement from the governor. To be fair here, I'll look that up.
Well, he denies it, and he says that there are people who were mm-hmm. on the airplane when the alleged strip poker incident took place who denied that it took place. But, you know, as I think Vera and Alan both said, this guy has got a resume now. We know anecdotally and from people who have been involved that he has been many times over his career a bully. I think it might have been on this program yesterday where someone raised Mario's name. And, you know, Mario did not have, to my knowledge, quite the same reputation,
no.
Although I do know that he had a bit of that reputation. But Andrew was his fixer during that period. So there's a long history with Andrew in this state. And when you throw in the statements by Assemblyman Kim about the bullying, and then you throw in this allegation about the strip poker, people can see it. They just sort of feel like there's something there, and now we're getting some more specifics about it. So if people are willing to believe it, it may be unfair for him if it's not the case, but it damages him. And I think, short of this strip poker allegation and sexual harassment allegation, short of that person, Boylan, coming forward and saying, I made it all up, the governor is entirely innocent, he is going to wind up having this stain on him. And I would add another two words to Alan's George Pataki, and these are two words that I think are favorable towards Cuomo, and that is Lee Zeldin, who I've read is a very much interested in becoming the governor. Lee Zeldin is a very conservative congressman from Long Island, and that would be the best news that Cuomo could have, in my opinion, because he's not a George Pataki who might attract people in the middle who are willing to give someone else, even a Republican, a chance. This guy is way out there.
In other words, who you got?
Yeah.
You can't beat somebody with nobody.
The other name that I'm tempted to bring up is Elise Stefanik, but I still believe she's running for vice president on the next Trump ticket.
Well, she may not have a congressional seat. That's what's interesting about
this.
In other words, if they combine her and the next district over in this, and the Democrats are going to be doing that right now, she could be out of that. I would love to see her run for governor. Love to see her run for governor.
I think it's telling that she hasn't said no. She hasn't.
I believe she's calling for Cuomo to be impeached.
She's
been out front on that.
She has not, and she's certainly going after the governor regularly. Malia, I want to get you in on this before we take a break.
Yeah, sure. So, all the accusers, obviously, they deserve to have all of their accusations thoroughly investigated. And so I look forward to what comes from that. And in the meantime, if I were Governor Cuomo, I would be focusing on trying to reopen the economy and keep the focus on that. So, for example, we've seen that the Catholic Archdiocese of New York has kept their schools open in person, a couple hundred schools throughout the state. They've been able to safely do that with masking and social distancing without a robust testing program. And they've shown that's possible. So I think if the governor focuses on things like that, and it seems like he's moving that direction because he's already announced some things such as summer camps are going to be open this summer.
Right.
And so I would expect to see more of those kinds of announcements from him.
I have two other words to inject. Term limits.
All right.
Wait. I missed those.
Term limits.
Well, I'm a great believer in term limits. I really am. I think, people who are in office, they have the advantage because everybody knows their names. But New York City certainly has term limits, except if you're Mike Bloomberg, and then you can buy an extra term, which is what happened. All too well supported by his city council, who said, if you're getting an extra term, so are we. But I'm all for term limits. I think it's a great idea.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld. We'll be back right after. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. We have a wonderful panel here, and we've got a lot to talk about. So let's go to the letters. Matt says, I just heard a panelist say Cuomo talks over his staff and doesn't take advice. So he's like Trump, an angry, arrogant, narcissistic, megalomaniac bully. Okay. Let's see. We go to Cameron. The panel totally missed the point. The only thing to say is Cuomo should be resigning today. We progressives cannot be hypocrites like those on the right. If this was a Republican, we would be all over them. We don't need more cases or any other information. It isn't an issue of stay quiet or make a political plan. If we want the moral high ground, we need to actually stand for it. Tell them it's over.
Well, I would, on this point, say everybody deserves an investigation. I don't, you know, it's the, it's often among the Democrats, if I remember the case of, the Minnesota representative, his name escapes me right now, the former comedian who was immediately attacked when information came out about his sexual harassment related issues. And, I think we need to investigate, slow down, investigate, and really disclose and be more transparent about the methodologies, the approaches to which we use to examine what is happening. And certainly we seem to have a pattern when it comes to Cuomo's behavior, bullying, and so on, but an investigation of his conduct, I think, is essential.
I do want to correct something that we mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, and that is there were two former aides to the governor who have accused him of sexual harassment. One is Karen Hinton, a former aide to Cuomo, as well
Correct.
As New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, and the other, of course, Lindsay Boylan, who we're talking about this morning. Mm-hmm. So you were correct in that. I apologize.
Yeah, I had seen the name come across the information this morning, and I thought, oh, how interesting. We'll have to see if more information comes out about his conduct. Yes,
John writes.
And I presume Vera is talking about Al Franken, who resigned on nothing more than allegations that that were far less serious, it seems to me, than mm-hmm. Cuomo is facing, and certainly more less serious than the charges against Trump, who seem to have survived despite all of the cases that came out of the woodwork against him. So, should Cuomo resign strictly based on these allegations? Well, historically, within his own party, that's been the case.
Right.
We go to this letter from John. Many women accused Donald Trump of sexual harassment and worse, mm-hmm. yet he was still elected president. The allegations of sexual harassment against Cuomo won't end his political career either. This one from Rob, it sounds like Governor Cuomo is committing political suicide. His old school techniques are being frowned upon, but he knows that ultimately he is responsible for what happens in his great state, which is why he is willing to stand up to advisors who may not have his best intentions in mind. Gavin Newsom is too young, handsome, and ambitious to get recalled. That from Rob.
Okay.
All right. We go to this letter from Erica. Alan said it best this morning that as long as men and women work together in a hierarchy, there will always be an opportunity for exploitation. However, mm-hmm. when will these high-ranking officials learn to never be alone in a room with the opposite sex ever? The military has a buddy rule, or did when I was in, so you are aware always three people deep at least.
Mike Pence.
Did the previous letter writer say that if these allegations are true, Cuomo's career would not be over? Because I believe if Cuomo does not survive based on these sexual harassment charges, he will never be elected anything again. He'll be in the mm-hmm. private sector.
Hmm.
I don't agree with Ira. You mean I have
you
my
think
own
if
issue?
He if he is found guilty in
what?
The broadest sense of this, that he could be reelected in this state or anywhere else?
In the broadest sense, meaning he kissed a woman on the lips. Listen, there's all kinds of sexual harassment in this world, and they are terrible accusations when they're there. But there's a long way to go here before kicking out a governor based on that. I have to say, a lot of people are willing to believe any accusation that is made against anybody. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that it will not work. If he's to be thrown out, you're going to have to find far worse than what you have right now. And the other thing that's somewhat troubling, I think you mentioned it, Ira, is that the accuser won't talk to the press.
Yeah.
You know, writes op-ed pieces, but won't talk to the press. You know, we are all for accusations, if they are correct, to come forward and to make a point. Nevertheless, you know, to some degree, there's a wide backlash in the population, which is proven by Trump, who I have nothing good to say about. But the fact of the matter is, he wasn't thrown out, and we really knew what he was up to sexually.
Well, Cuomo's accuser is running for borough president of Manhattan, so she's not going to be able to avoid the press much longer. So
but
let's see what happens when they talk to her.
Ira and Ellen, don't you think that also it's a matter of concern? She shouldn't be really talking to the press. That is not where we should be taking an investigation about what took place and how it took place. And, you know, if this is a serious, which appears to be a serious accusation, the press is not where it needs to go. I mean, these are the issues.
I agree with you, Vera, but if the governor's office comes out and says she was never on a plane alone with the governor, the obvious thing that you want to do as a journalist is ask her, okay, they say this, now what's your response? Mm-hmm. And if she says no response, I don't know what you're left with there. I mean, I agree with you that this shouldn't be fought out in the press, but by the same token, mm-hmm. these questions are going to come up, and How do you not answer them?
Now, maybe I'm not following this.
Well, I don't know that we need
one second,
Vera.
One second. Yeah. Just 1 second. And then you go. But didn't she write an op-ed piece in the press?
No. She wrote an article. She wrote an essay that was published online. It wasn't like in a journalistic publication.
Nevertheless, she courted that publicity, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But as far as now, if you go to her and say we want to ask you questions about this, she has not talked. Got my third letter on this, so I want to finally hopefully make this right. The Karen Hinton accusal of Cuomo was for bullying, mm-hmm. not for sexual harassment. So that distinction. So the Lindsay Boylan complaint is the sole sexual harassment complaint. The Karen Hinton accusation against the governor was for bullying. Peter writes, I firmly believe that Cuomo is too smart to have made those sexual advances and the allegations will soon fall apart. But then again, I said the same thing about Bill Clinton. Dare says victims of harassment do not owe the media interviews, to Vera's point. Malia, would you like to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I think some of the discussion here underscores why it's often very difficult for victims to come forward. So whether or not the accuser penned an op-ed doesn't necessarily mean that she should be open to all kinds of other criticism, or that she is announcing her availability for all kinds of public public discussion, or that she's available to the press. Now, obviously, people are going to want to ask questions and learn more about it, but I really hesitate to criticize her for not making herself available to the press. I don't think that's a reasonable expectation of someone who's making an accusation. I think we need to focus on investigations. She deserves that, and Governor Cuomo deserves that as well, a clear, thorough investigation.
So who investigates?
isn't there a process for this in the state government? Inspector generals, or I'm not familiar with all the structures, but
The leaders of both houses of the legislature have already checked in and saying that this is deeply disturbing. Now, I have a feeling that's because there's not a good relationship between the governor and them. They may feel they've been bullied, too, you know, and that this offers an opportunity. Are you going to have the legislature, which has already spoken, the leaders have already spoken, are you going to have them do the investigation?
Meanwhile, Alan, you sent me an interesting note here that the governor, this is a job posting that that was posted yesterday. The governor is looking for a senior communications lead for strategy and messaging. Whatever would their job be?
Listen, governor, don't put your foot in it anymore.
Well, but let's just go back a half a step. This is a woman who is running for public office in New York City.
$150K
a
year,
by the way. Questioned about this and any number of other things. Who else, other than a town hall where the general public could question the candidates, the reporters are the ones who are going to be questioning her about this and other subjects. If she is a private citizen, I think I take Malia's point. You don't want to make her the victim twice, but you're running for public office. You're going to be asked questions about this. We want to learn about her veracity. It's got to be in a public setting. She's put herself in that position.
So, Ira, don't you think it's quite possible for journalists to investigate whether she was on the plane with Cuomo by herself or not, to look at some records,
and
to
I'm
ask
sure
for those
being,
records?
That's why they've already released the manifest of it.
So I don't know that you necessarily need to speak with her. You just investigate.
Well, first rule of newspapers and probably policing is speak to the primary source, and we know where she is, and she's raised the issue, mm-hmm. so she should be questioned.
Well, I don't agree that I would, if I was in the middle of a sexual harassment accusation or issue, I don't think I would want to have that discussed in the media. I personally would want to have that investigated. If I was, pursuing that angle instead of just mentioning it publicly and then never going there again. But if I mention it publicly and I wanted to have it investigated, I would pursue an investigation through the political process or the legal, through a legal.
We are desperately late. I do wonder the question, to Ira's point, though. I do wonder the question, if you make an allegation in the public and you go out into a public sphere, that there are obvious questions that both the press and the public are going to ask. And I'm not saying it's right for those questions to be asked, but they're going to be asked. And I don't know where. So you go with the investigation, but those questions are still going to linger. And what effect they have on it does, I think somebody, one of the legislators said, this ends up being a he said, she said. And isn't that the problem ultimately with these stories?
Well, that's right. If you question the person and you take the measure of the person based on the answers that he or she gives, and you get a chance to look these people in the eye.
All right. We're late. Let me take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. Alan Chartok is here. Malia Dumont, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to our panel discussion. Many letters that we have gotten, so I want to get to those. We welcome yours. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Vera Acarius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld, all making up the panel this morning. So here we go to the letters. Robert says, maybe I missed it, but why did she come forward now with the allegation against the governor that was alleged taking place 2016 to 2018? Well, she can make it whenever she wants, right?
Yes, I mean, she could. My only question, of course, it's justified to ask those questions, but that's why I'm suggesting it should be a more thorough investigation rather than in the court of public opinion.
Let's see. I very much appreciate the input from Vera Malia this morning, says Kate, as a nurse practitioner in women's health and a woman. I would gently remind the panel that studies show false allegations of sexual harassment and assault are uncommon, as the repercussions of coming forward often outweigh the possibility of justice being served. Please remember that all comments on the show regarding the credibility of Boylan's allegations are most certainly being heard and internalized by listeners who have experienced sexual harassment and assault. Regardless of the political context, we need to listen to women. We go to Dennis, who says the news stories on this are getting loosely worded and inaccurate, probably getting steered there by Cuomo's office. The confusion helps teen Cuomo to obfuscate. You were just discussing whether Boylan was ever alone on the plane with the governor. She never claimed to have been. She says the governor was across from her, a press aide next to her, a trooper behind her. She said she was alone with him in the Capitol and his New York City office. Jacob says, to Vera's point, the only avenue for investigation here, since no crime is alleged, is a private lawsuit and the discovery that comes from that, unless, of course, there is a state legislature investigation. But the accuser chose to launch her attacks online. Of course, the public has the right to ask questions if the accuser chooses a public forum. And of course, it's okay for the public to ask all the relevant questions. Of course, we should protect the victim's rights to seek an investigation. But the when and how of a disclosure matters. She has opened the door and ought not hide behind privacy after a public attack. John says, of course, a person who writes repeated public accusations in the context of repeated fail runs for public office is obligated to be available to the press. If that's not the case, then the press would have a positive obligation not to publish the allegations. Why should the press allow itself to be used to broadcast unsubstantiated accusations without access to the accuser? Steve says J-COPE has authority to investigate sexual harassment by elected officials, for whatever that's worth. Alan, anything on J-COPE?
No.
Okay.
Nothing on J-COPE other than to say it has proven itself to be either worthless or next to worthless. You know, the investigative group that does the investigating should have some creds of its own and some history.
Keith writes, I'm a former George Pataki and Chris Gibson voter. After the last 4 years, I cannot see myself voting for another Republican ever again. And the best that they are going to offer are Lee Zeldin and Elise Stefanik and or ha ha ha. I can't imagine sycophants from the Republican Party ever getting us through a crisis like we dealt with last year in New York. My family survived the worst crisis of my lifetime. What else do you think I will judge Cuomo on if he decides to run again?
You know, fair is fair, but I got to tell you, Chris Gibson is an extraordinary man, and he is not in the same boat as some of the others who have been named here.
No, I think she said she voted for him. She was,
she voted for
Pataki and for Gibson, and saying that Zeldin and Stefanik are no Gibson or Pataki.
On that note, I also wanted to say that Chris Gibson, of course, is the president of Siena College, and he has done a fantastic job on our campus in terms of our amazing recruitment of students and our safety procedures. We are, you know, half of our courses are in the classroom, and we are having a good experience so far for spring semester.
Well, he is a terrific person. I agree with
that. He is.
All right, let's go to Kathy. I personally have been affected by supposed charges. An investigation ensued, and my political career was over, even after the investigation warranted no findings of misconduct. Cuomo should stand his ground, period. That from Kathy. We go to Paul, who says, as a Manhattan borough president candidate, Boylan desperately needs press. The timing of her accusations deserves to be factored in. Cuomo is a known quantity and thus an easy target. The accusations failed the first contact with reality when all the other people on the plane said it wasn't possible to have happened. That was in December, and then the resurfacing of the allegation yesterday. And finally on this subject, Claire checks in and says, although I am not in general a huge fan of Andrew Cuomo, I do remember how early on in the pandemic, most people were concerned that their loved ones would not be accepted back into nursing homes after going to the hospital after COVID. The big concern at the time was families would have to scramble to find other placements for their loved ones, and were asking Cuomo to make sure this would not happen. Now, with hindsight, he is being blamed for nursing home COVID problems. Seems like a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. that from Claire. All right, let's move on to other topics. And again, we welcome your letters. We go to, let's talk about the post office for a few minutes. This is always an interesting story and something that people are invested in, whether you want to be or not, right? You need the post office. So here we go. The President Biden has nominated three to the USPS, United States Postal Service, Board of Governors, as DeJoy testifies on the mail crisis. So this from the Washington Post, the White House move toward reasserting control of the United States Postal Service on Wednesday, even as its Republican Postmaster generally, as its Republican Postmaster General defiantly told Congress he would press forward with plans to raise prices and slow the mail, brushing off calls for him to resign. President Biden named two Democrats and a voting rights advocate to fill three of the four openings on the Postal Service's governing board, according to three people briefed on the discussion and later confirmed by the White House. If all three win Senate confirmation, the nine-member board would be made up of equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans, with McReynolds, whose organization is a darling of the left-leaning groups, as the lone independent. The new slate would create a Democratic advantage and potentially the votes to oust DeJoy, whose summer overhaul led to precipitous service declines that snarled up untold numbers of Americans' bills, prescriptions, and paychecks. DeJoy, with the current board's backing, slashed overtime and dramatically reduced mail processing capabilities, moves deemed by an inspector general's audit to reflect a lack of preparation or concern for how they might affect service. So that is what we're going with here, Alan.
I can't wait to see this guy go, and I'm sure he will, for all of us, and that includes me, who has waited weeks and weeks for a letter that should have been, you know, come to us the next day. This guy has ruined the post office, and as far as I'm concerned, he ought to be kicked out and is with a hard, as hard a boot as absolutely possible. What a jerk.
Well, this guy certainly is no Ray Heatherton, who people of a certain age will remember was the very mailman on TV.
I remember him well, yeah.
He is a hard ass, and he comes across that way. And I agree with Alan's assessment. But that said, he was put in there largely because he had a a bottom line guy reputation, and the post office is in serious financial trouble. I think I read nearly $2 billion with a B dollars in liabilities, for obvious reasons. I mean, there's less mail going out now, and the expenses are still very high. So they brought him in there to trim the fat. But I think what the critics of the post office have not entirely grasped is how important the Postal Service is in this country. And I suspect that of the many agencies around this country, the post office is one where the general public is supportive of it. It wants it to continue. It performs a service. So I think that on the one hand, I'll agree that this guy is a hard ass and bad news. On the other hand, he is trying to trim the expenses, and I think they need to give him a different direction. Do the best you can to continue to do good service and find places to make some cuts if it's possible.
I know the right direction. Out the door.
I would have to agree.
I mean, look, let's face it. If we are in a place where the post office is costing too much money, pay the bill. It's worth doing.
I agree with that. I don't want you to think I'm defending him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Vera.
Yeah. So I wanted to comment on two things, and Ira went that direction as well. And I agree with what both Alan and Ira said so far. The post office is absolutely essential, particularly in its services to rural and more remote areas. I mean, post offices in small towns, at least pre-COVID and will again post-COVID, serve as a networking center. people go there to chat with each other, to get information. There are boards where you post information. You pick up your medicine, you pick up your bills, and you mingle with members in your small community. You drive into town maybe once every 3 days or so. This is a way to connect the rural areas to the city. The post office plays an exceptionally important role in that sense, a social role to for the common good. And the idea to destroy it, to weaken it, and to turn it into a business venture is appalling to me. In addition to that, I wanted to point out that the morale among postal workers is very low. This DeJoy has taken all the joy out of people's labor.
Darn, I was going to do that.
People had a sense of pride in their work. And now they're basically, you know, I mean, the emergency measures in terms of postal workers having to work at night, on the weekend, to deliver, to hunt down packages and letters that are misplaced. I mean, it's mayhem in the system. And that is because of DeJoy.
Malia Dumont.
It has been said in many circles that part of DeJoy's marching orders was to diminish confidence in the Postal Service so that confidence would be diminished regarding elections and mail-in voting,
right,
et cetera.
Yep.
Malia.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah, I live in Kingston, and right around Christmas time was talking to my local postman, a very nice guy, hardworking, and it was 10:30 at night, and he was out delivering mail, and he said, I can't continue to live like this. He was emblematic of the larger morale issues that Vera just alluded to. But I think it's also, obviously, this is a demonstration of the scope of Trumpism, that even an organization that's, widespread across the country that's focused on logistics can manage to be politicized, despite the fact that it has a governing board that's large enough to try to avoid politicization, even despite all of those structural things that are put in place to avoid politicization. It's the post office, too, has become part of this larger political question. So I really hope that DeJoy can be ousted and we can get back towards a post office that's focused on its work instead of being politicized.
I don't understand. Can someone tell me that this idea that you are intentionally slowing the mail doesn't make sense to me? I mean, it would seem to me, even under whatever circumstances you're dealing with, you wouldn't say, oh, well, we need to do is slow things down, especially if you're trying to help the overall fiscal picture of the post office. Does anyone want to take that?
Well, they wanted to slow things down so that the elections would not come in on time.
I'm sorry. It was, Ira, go ahead.
The election could be the primary reason why he would want to slow the mail down.
Right.
But when he says we're going to have to raise the rates and in addition to this, service will be poor, that doesn't quite add up in any business.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think your point, whoever made the point just now, whether it was Ira or one of the other people, this election was run and probably won based on, mail-in ballots. And I think an awful lot of people suspected that Trump was opposed to trying to do anything to slow down the mail. Because if it came in after a certain time, it would be disqualified. The rest of it in Georgia right now, I believe there's an effort to change, vote by mail. So there is a political rationale for all of this, too.
And we remember pictures of the machines that were taken off of line and destroyed, the high-speed sorting machines that occurred before the election, presumably at Trump's request.
Unbelievable.
And then also just remember, in terms of public service, the simple removal of post office boxes across rural areas so people couldn't drop off mail.
Right.
They had to drive much longer. How about you have to drive for a half hour to even drop off a letter with a stamp?
Yeah,
we had
one in our corner here, and I wrote a column saying exactly that, Vera.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that people would congregate. They would stand there. They would talk to each other at the mailbox. I mean, some things are just worth it.
That's right.
I think part of the difficulty in coming to terms with this, just wrapping our minds around it, is just baldly stating that DeJoy's goal was not to make the post office more efficient and more effective. And we expect our public leaders, our government officials, to try to do the best job they can. But that's not what his goal was ever. So his goal was to lower confidence and to focus on politics. And so in that context, it's not surprising the things that he did, even though they're completely absurd, that the Postmaster General would be trying to make things more inefficient and ineffective. But that's in line with the goals that he had, the political goals that he had for this organization.
From as long as I can remember, Alan, the post office has always been referred to as a quasi-government agency. What are the problems with such quasi-public agencies? I mean, are we not seeing that develop right now?
Yes. You know, I think the idea that people wanted their cake and eat it, and now they're figuring out what's going on. You know, you had these efforts to privatize the post office, to make it more responsive, and then all of a sudden we found out what happens when you put some of these things into the hands like of a guy like DeJoy. It's awful. So we have to learn that lesson. You know, Mario used to tell me all the time about the post office being a socialist agency, you know, and people were saying, you're for socialism. And he would say, yeah, I'm for the post office, I'm for this, that. And he was always right.
When you think of how something like this ends, I guess I'm fascinated by the putting these people on this board and having it be more equal Republican and Democrat. But if DeJoy, ultimately, it's up to him, right? I mean, even you can scream and yell that you want him to resign, but he doesn't have to.
No, that's right. That's right, until they fire him. And I think when Biden put these new people on there on the controlling board, the word fire is really written in bold print, you know, above all of that.
All right. Let's see. We only have a minute or two before we have to go take a break. So I will quickly bring up this story and then we'll go to a break and fully discuss it when we come back. This is about the immigration policy of President Biden. President Biden's promise to restore the U.S.'s reputation as a beacon for the globe by reopening the nation's doors to immigrants and refugees. But he has infuriated some supporters by expelling tens of thousands of migrants, restoring an unlicensed shelter for migrant children, and struggling to implement policy changes without a full staff in place. This from the Washington Post. After barely a month in office, Biden is scrambling to explain to some Democrats that his day one promises for a gentler immigration system will take more time with health and economic crises engulfing the United States. The risks of an early political backlash for Biden are growing. Former President Donald Trump dispatched his deputies to the Hill on Wednesday to lobby against Biden's immigration overhauls, and Trump plans to blast those changes in a speech at the CPAC conference on Sunday. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement email obtained by the Washington Post shows that the administration has already entered crisis mode on the southern border. Alan.
Well, you know, Trump knew, you know, he's an evil man, but he's not a stupid man. Well, maybe he is stupid. But in any case, you know, his position on immigration was lock the doors. You know, to everybody in the United States, and they do their polling and they find out that people don't want other people in. I do. I love the idea of enriching our population. But I think from a political standpoint, Trump did what he thought would excite his base the most. And now along comes Biden. He takes a look at the same situation and he doesn't want to make a mistake. He doesn't want to open the doors to the point where everybody who wants to comes in, and there has to be provision for those folks. And that is why you better believe that Biden is testing the waters.
Vera? Well, actually, let's hold. I'll hold off on everybody else because we're going to take a break. And then when we come back, we'll continue and we'll round out our last segment together on this issue, as well as a lot of letters on the Postal Service that have come in over the last few minutes. So we'll do all of that. Alan Chartok.
They didn't come in via the mail.
No, the email. Which killing okay, the post office. Alan Chartok, Malia DeMont, Vera Carius-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Last call for this morning and our final segment together. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Right before the break, we introduced the topic of President Biden and his immigration policy, and basically looking that after a month in office, the president is scrambling to explain to many that his day one promises for a gentler immigration system will take more time with health and economic crises engulfing the United States. Alan, we got your perspective on this. So did we? Or no, we did?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So now let's move to Malia.
Yeah, so I think the Washington Post story sort of mischaracterizes the situation. Clearly, it is a crisis for the people who are at the border. I'm not sure it's really a political crisis for Biden yet. Some of the people that he's working with, allies and nonprofit organizations that are trying to support immigrants, they've also called for patience. And this is also not a new situation. The Washington Post makes it sound like there's this enormous new problem. And this goes back over a decade. Even under President George W. Bush, there's a lot of attention on people crossing the border, especially unaccompanied minor children. It was an issue the government was working on back then. And Congress at that point unanimously passed a law calling for unaccompanied minors to be released into the least restrictive settings. So it wasn't that long ago that Congress was kinder and gentler to people trying to cross the border. I think we can move back in that direction. It does take a little bit of time. It's not necessarily surprising, or it doesn't prevent immigration policy from being updated, the fact that we don't have a new director in place yet. I mean, these things will all be happening in the coming days. We want to move as quickly as possible to help the people at the border, prevent any personal crises for people who are there. But I don't think it's the political crisis that the Washington Post is calling it.
Ira.
Well, the two pieces of that story in the Washington Post jumped out at me. The first one you alluded to, Joe, which was, Trump dispatching people to Washington to lobby in Congress. And then if you go farther down in that article, lo and behold, there's the name Stephen Miller, quote, the architect of Trump's immigration strategy, who briefed GOP lawmakers this week on the Biden administration's immigration changes and urged them to continue hammering away at the issue, which he said could help Republicans in the midterm elections next year. So I do think the politics comes into play. This raises quite a red flag for me, a large red flag. I don't recall, and that doesn't mean it hasn't happened, a former president, quote unquote, dispatching people to Washington to lobby on his policies. But it's clearly, if that part of it is true, and Miller's appearance certainly is true, there is a big political piece of this puzzle, and it's already an extremely complex puzzle. Immigration is not something that can be solved easily, and so the active influence of Trump's people concerns me.
Yeah, let me add a couple of things to that.
Sure.
Of course, all of these issues we have discussed are very important. The Trump lobbyist strategy is to completely undermine an immigration bill that would legalize 11 million people who are in this country and have been here for years, sometimes even a decade. The number one goal is to weaken any immigration reform, which is something that Biden promised he would do ASAP, which was an overpromise on his part, but he needed a lot of support from Latino voters. So he put out there a promise that he would address this. He has not yet firmly asserted how he will go forward on DACA. He has not yet fully disclosed how he will pursue a step-by-step immigration bill to legalize 11 million people. We also expect, as is common in the spring, a surge on the southern border. And that requires, if we want to reshift the position, to invest heavily into Central America and Mexico, to reestablish business connections. And of course, we know that the current president in Mexico had a reasonably good relationship with Trump, even though, you know, he's on the far left, but that's a more complicated story. Right. We have poor infrastructure on the border, and we now know that we have many, many, many young adults or children that are unaccompanied. Still, the first success that I would say the Biden administration can tout is that the committee, the task force with the pro bono lawyers and advocates on the southern border that is supervised by a federal judge has found parents of 105 separated children this past month. That is a success because the Trump administration insisted they could not be found. The first success is 105 separated children are now whose parents are now identified. That process can go forward. Now there's still over 500 children somewhere looking for their parents because of deportation procedures, the zero tolerance policy that Trump implemented. So these are the issues Biden has to address. I believe he has overpromised, and he will get a lot of criticism from the left because it is, as everyone pointed out, an incredibly difficult task.
I realize.
Agree on immigration reform.
Yeah, I realize that it is complex, and I realize that we're talking about overpromising, which I understand. But it brings us to a core issue, Alan, that I think most new presidents have to deal with, and that is how patient are people for the guy in charge to solve really, really big problems?
The question, as I have said before, is one of political salience. Is this issue the kind of thing that will get somebody to act in a political fashion the same way as COVID, for example? Now, you know, I think that's what's perplexing the Biden administration. They don't know which way to go. There's the right thing. Look, my father was an immigrant. My mother was one generation away. The whole country is a nation of immigrants, as we know. If the president can't sell that to the American people, which is, let's remember where we all came from, because that's a part of this. If he can't sell that, he's doomed, or she's doomed, whoever it is, you know, at the time. So it's one of those amorphous kinds of issues that really is going to drive Biden and every other person in that office nuts.
Go ahead, Vera.
Yep. I wanted to just comment on another issue. There is absolutely no way that the flow of migrants and refugees from Central America to the United States will slow down. We have environmental conditions that are worsening. We have the dry corridor in Central America. People can't sustain themselves. They can't make a living. Then you have violence. Then you have poverty. These are issues that need to be addressed systematically across borders. That is something that should be part of the, you know, whole environmental and infrastructure discussion. Mm-hmm. Regional approaches. That is something the Biden administration has not yet discussed. It is essential. Otherwise, these problems will not be resolved.
You mean publicly discussed, because we don't really know what they're doing.
I'm not privy to his private conversations, so I'm saying publicly there hasn't been any initiation of those kinds of thoughts.
I suspect that's because they think it's a little...
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alan, and then we'll go to Malia.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead, Malia.
I was just going to mention, there are other things the Biden administration can be working on, too. Immigration is obviously such a broad issue, and the southern border is not the only place where Trump had
terrible, really detrimental policies. He also launched all kinds of attacks and tried to weaken some of the visa system. And so Biden can reverse some of those decisions, some of the ways that Trump tried to make it more difficult for people to get visas. Those things he can do a lot more easily and quickly. And I expect to see action on that a little bit sooner than some of the action on the border.
We are just about out of time. We have a few moments, and I just want to end with some letters that we got, because we had quite a few on the Postal Service that came in right before the break. So I want to get to them now. Emily says, isn't one of the main causes of the post office's financial problems the law the Republicans put into place years ago that mandates it to pre-fund 75 years' worth of retiree health benefits? Simple solution, get rid of DeJoy and that stupid law. Pete says DeJoy was installed for two reasons. One, Trump's, one, his own, to stop mail-in voting by delay and incompetence, and for DeJoy to promote his own package service. Pretty transparent chicanery, says Pete.
Pete's good.
We go to Melissa, who says, I could not agree more with Vera's comments about the importance of the rural post offices. I live in one of those rural areas and was shocked to find out that the postal workers in my post office have not been vaccinated. I can assure you these people are definitely essential. All right. We go to this letter from Carolyn, who says, also FedEx and UPS hand off their rural routes to the post office, so they are delivering packages for those companies as well. So that another aspect to the story of why these post offices are overrun.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of competition, right? The post office didn't imagine itself being in a competitive capitalistic environment where they have to, you know, sort of make packages. You know, you can deliver faster than UPS, but you might have to, or Federal Express, but you have to make it less expensive. I mean, these are all very serious challenges to the existence of the post office.
And I thought we made this painfully clear and obvious, but we got two letters on this, so I just want to address it, of saying that we were bad-mouthing the men and women who work at the post office.
We love the men and women at the post office. And we have said so over and over and over.
Our issue is with the management of the post office and what is happening.
Right. Yeah. We actually say that morale, I just said that morale was low because people felt mistreated and disrespected in the post office as often, and I think they deserve much better as postal workers.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning. It is terrific to have you all here. Alan, thank you very much. Always good
thank
to
you, Joe,
speak. Thank you. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you. Malia Dumont, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you. Vera Icarios-Kelly, thanks to you. And Ira, be well. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Joe.
Be well.
Bye-bye,
all right.
Joe, bye,
thank
everyone.
You. We will continue in just a moment with the Congressional Corner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.